Thank you, Tom. Very happy to be here. And I guess Steve Radakovich is one of the people who called me and talked me into doing this, among a few others. And I've never been to BIF before. Looks like a fun place to be, good group of people. It's been a good program so far. I know there's an awful lot of people here that I know from other meetings and locations, and a good part of them know that I've left the University of Missouri and we're planning on moving to Idaho, and I got the question marks there because, you know, I never know from one week to the next when I get to sell out and move. Yesterday when I put this program together, I just had, you know, Brookfield, Missouri on there, and then I talked to my wife last night. We've got a showing on our farm on Saturday, so maybe we'll get sold out and I can go ahead and move to Idaho. That's what it's contingent on. So right now I'm in a state of flux. Some people have asked me for my business card, and I don't have a business card right now because I haven't had that flash moment of waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and knowing what the business is going to be called. So there's that. And if you're going to move shortly, why make cards that have lies on them about where you live and stuff? So I don't have any cards. At the end of the presentation, I do have a slide that has contact information if there's anyone who would like to get in touch with me. Okay, the theme here has been meeting production challenges, and particularly with tall fescue. And both Tom Jenkins and Steve, when they talked to me about this, said the audience will be from all over the country, and there's people who don't have anything to do with fescue. And so I should say something about adverse environments in general, but focus on fescue. So that's kind of where I'm heading. And obviously I pushed the wrong button. Let me come over here and push the escape key. Hell, that's not going to work. Yeah, somebody kill that. Thank you for... Hey, Alicia, good to see you back. You know, first slide and I screw it up. All right. Obviously, beef is produced in a lot of different environments. And we're always real good at looking over the fence and thinking about how good other people have it. And, you know, how rough it is where we have to work and produce. And, you know, we all face challenges. I got pictures from different locations there. And some of the things that we complain about are infected tall fescue, been the theme so far this morning. Sure, there's people around who curse fescue, but you know what? If the state of Missouri didn't have 8 million acres of fescue, we wouldn't have 2+ million beef cows, and another half of the state would be down in Louisiana. So there's, you know, good and bad to everything. Too dry. Well, some people out west. Oh, there it is. The club. You know, too dry. Been a real problem out in the west. But you know what? You get in that too dry environment and parasites aren't much of a problem, are they? You don't have to contend with mud and stuff like that. So there's a silver lining. Summer too short. Well, this is actually about where I'm going to move to in Idaho. And they say if summer comes on a weekend this year, let's have a picnic. Some places are winter is too long and you have to feed hay too long. One of the most interesting pieces of feeding statistics that I find in the U.S. is if you take that central corridor, what I call the three M's, the state of Minnesota, the average cow-calf producer in Minnesota feeds hay 130 days a year, plus or minus. The average cow-calf producer in Missouri feeds hay 130 days, plus or minus. Mississippi, the average cow-calf producer feeds hay 130 days. So what the hell does climate have to do with how much hay we feed? You know, making hay is a bad habit we get into and we feed to whatever we produce. So there's challenges like this all over. And regardless of what those particular challenges are, we're all dealing with the same issue. And the issue is producing a calf every 12 months. You know, Tom Gary gave a good talk last night, and I remember one of the things he said was basically, folks, this is not new data. I'm not going to talk a lot about new data either or new ideas. It comes down to the issue is producing a calf every 12 months. The challenge to do that is maintaining adequate dietary intake. Both Dr. Hovland and Dr. Browning related to the fescue issue that one of the primary problems we have is reduced intake. Now, why exactly do they have reduced intake? Is it because of hormonal control of appetite, or is it because they're spending 80% of the time standing under the shade tree and they don't have time to go out to eat? It's the same issue, is adequate dietary intake. When we have a drought out in the west and it's a quarter mile between blades of grass, what's the problem? Maintaining adequate dietary intake. Comes back to that same old issue. And the key here is maintaining adequate availability of quality forage. And whereas this is a focus on infected tall fescue, perhaps I should have said maintaining adequate availability of non-toxic quality forage. So that's the issue that we're dealing with, and the key solution is actually quite simple, except for we have to bring in the economic challenges, and it's doing it cost effectively. And then we also have social issues coming into play, particularly on public land. But we have animal welfare issues also. So I could say the real challenge is maintaining adequate dietary intake cost effectively in a socially acceptable way. So we have challenges at the biophysical level, at the economic level, and increasingly at the social level. I'm not going to deal with economics. Well, I'll get to it somewhere in here probably. Of course, they always say, what is it they always say? Something about if you have an agronomist presenting economic information, all you have is an agronomist's view of economics. All right. So here we are, same old story of matching animal demand with forage supply. And how many years has this been what we talk about? You know, we always say, you got to match your forage and your livestock resources. The real challenge is, how do you actually do that? How do you actually do that? It's easy to talk about, good thing to say, but there's some real issues here that we need to seriously think about, look at, forget some of the traditional approaches to when we calve, when we breed, or maybe not forget about it, but think about why do we actually do things certain times of year. And that's where I want to go from here for a while, then we'll come back to fescue. I think everybody realizes forage production is seasonal. I'm using just a cool season grass example. This is a real classic curve that we see, day of the year, daily pasture growth. This is actually in pounds per acre per day. Holy cow! You know, some of you guys out west don't grow 120 pounds per acre in a year, let alone on a day. When the weather's real nice in Missouri, it rains, it's 78 degrees, sun shining. Yeah, we can grow 120 pounds of forage per acre per day. It'll crank. Summertime, it slows down. So the shape of the curve changes some, the height, how much you produce, how little you produce, what time of the year it occurs, that varies. But basically, most of us have this issue of a whole lot of grass part of the year, not much the rest of the year. And we can take that one step further and look at, well, we basically have some cool season environments, we have some warm season environments, we have some garden spots on Earth, like North Missouri, where we grow cool season and warm seasons both, and we can grow all kinds of stuff, have an extended season. But in a lot of places, particularly in what we would classify as adverse environments, you either have one or the other, and you have a high peak and not much production the rest of the time. One of my favorite places to visit is Queensland, Australia, where it rains, you know, 30 to 60 days a year, and then it never rains again. And you spend 10 months budgeting out what grew in that little peak of time. Okay. So if we think about peak forage supply, we have a couple times when they can occur. You know, we have a cool season window, we have a warm season window there, and we get a lot of grass at some time. We have another challenge that comes up in that yield and quality are inversely related. As we push a pasture towards higher yield, either through resting it or advancing towards maturity, quality always goes down. So on, if you want to look at it on a year-round basis, we need to look at the peaks of when we have forage supply available, look at when we have animal demand, try to bring those together. But peak yield does not necessarily mean it is the optimal situation for the cattle, because we also have to look at quality. And when peak yield occurs, does not necessarily coincide with peak quality. So we need to sort that out a little bit. There's a couple of differences between cool season and warm season forages that I want to bring out. Is when quality becomes a limiting factor in cool season grasses, it is usually energy that is limiting. In the 20 plus years that I spent in pasture research, grazing research at the University of Missouri, very, very, very rarely did we ever see the protein level in a managed cool season pasture drop below the minimum level required for whatever class of livestock we were dealing with, whether it's, you know, growing steers, lactating cows, dry cows. Rarely was protein ever a problem. Heck of a lot of protein supplementation gets sold in the Midwest to supplement tall fescue, low quality tall fescue pastures, and protein is absolutely not a problem there, unless it's completely mismanaged, then it can be. On the other hand, with warm season grasses, generally we're looking at the first limiting nutrient being protein. And if we supplement with protein, we can get adequate energy digestion out of that forage. So when we start looking at, again, matching animal demand and forage supply, these are, as well as availability, is it protein that's going to be limiting? Is it going to be energy that's going to be limiting? When are the cows' requirements for energy the greatest? When are they the lowest? How do we bring these into balance? All right. Forage supply is seasonal. Forage quality fluctuates. Cow demand is also seasonal, largely driven by calving. We have month of the year here, metabolizable energy. Energy demand is highest at peak lactation, which typically comes 30 to 90 days post-calving. We have a rise in nutritional demand as the cow goes into late gestation, increases, and how much it increases at lactation depends on milking ability of the cow. And it can be anywhere from, you know, 25-30% increase in energy requirement at lactation, clear on up to close to 100% with some of the higher milk-producing breeds. Now, I'm just going to use that 100% figure. Now I'll use 50%. If energy demand goes up 50% at peak lactation compared to dry maintenance, in essence, you have 1.5 times as many animals on the place at peak lactation as you do at maintenance, which means you have to either have fat cows going into calving and lactation, or you need to have a lot more forage available. And obviously I'm a forage guy, I don't talk much about supplementation. You have to have a lot more forage available when those cows are at peak lactation than when they're at dry maintenance, if you want to try to do this in a cost-effective manner. I'm going to look at some figures here. For 7 or 8 years in the late 80s and early 90s, we milked a lot of beef cows. We did some studies where we weaned the calves off at typically 75 to 90 days and then milked the cows twice a day, just like dairy cows, to look at lactation response to forage management. We had other studies where we milked them every 4 weeks, 2 alternate day milkings after overnight separation. And, you know, we did a lot looking at the lactation response, when we had forage available, things like that. And we had one set of cows with an average calving date of March 1st. This is daily milk yield. And with an average calving date of March 1st, back here March 1st, peak lactation came May 13th, On the other axis over here, we have, again, that pasture daily growth rate, pounds per acre per day. And we have lactation starting here in March. And let me advance this one. What I have in the, I went ahead and hash marked in the area between the lactation. This is when that acceleration of energy demand is going to occur. Shoots up rapidly. Our grass starts growing a little bit later on. This area of increased energy demand here typically comes from harvested forage. Now, it can come off the fat, off a cow's back. It can come from harvested forage. It can come from grain supplementation. It can come from a number of places, but my point is it's not coming from green grass. So it tends to be more expensive unless you're a really good job of managing fat on a cow. And you can do that. Now, if we look at the growth curve a little bit, this is nitrogen-fertilized tall fescue. And this is the typical pattern that we see. 120 pounds of nitrogen, 40 pounds end of March, 40 pounds 1st of June, 40 pounds 1st of September. We've got a lot of grass in the spring, not much out here in the summertime. So we have a gap occurring here, and we also have a gap occurring out here. We're still milking quite a bit out here. We're not producing much forage out there in July and August on a nitrogen-fertilized fescue pasture. We don't have a very good match of forage supply and animal demand. Let's slide calving date over to April 15th, and in the study that we did, it was March 26th, and I took the March 26th calving day lactation curve. It peaks higher, and I just slid it over to make the beginning of calving basically occur after or when we start having good grass growth. And so here, the extra energy required for lactation and gain comes from fresh pasture. We don't have that gap in big energy demand going with lactation. We still have a lot of problems out here in the summertime. But this is one of the, you know, just the basic concept of bringing animal demand, when you have the highest animal demand, into sync with when you have the greatest forage supply. On a warm season, like in the sandhills of Nebraska or somewhere, the timing is going to be different because the growth curves are different. In New Mexico, on a little narrow window of grass growth that occurs in the summertime, when calving occurs to make this match is going to be different. But that's just the basic concept. I want to look, before we get into some of the problems with this, I want to look at diversifying the pasture as a tool to change the shape of the forage supply curve. We've done a lot of work over the last 10 to 15 years looking at diverse pasture mixtures. And this is the curve that you saw before of the nitrogen, the tall fescue fertilized with 120 pounds of nitrogen. And then this is a diverse mixture that includes tall fescue, orchard grass, timothy, red clover, birdsfoot trefoil. And then it also has some volunteer components of crabgrass, annual espadiza, which is a warm season legume in. But it's real typical of what our managed or management intensive grazing pastures would look like. And you can see that we don't have that extreme spring peak. We have a little more even production through the summer, still drop off there in the fall some. But which curve do you think is going to be easier to manage from a forage utilization standpoint? Well, the one with the less extreme in it. But you might look at this and say, God, but you're giving up an awful lot of production there in the spring. You want to see something really interesting? These lines drawn across here are the mean pasture daily growth rate. And you know what? There's virtually no difference when you look at the mean. We get just as much production through the entire grazing season on average from the diverse pasture as we do from the nitrogen fertilized pasture. If you love making hay, this is great. If you view making hay as one of the worst habits, you know, I drink a little beer and I have some other bad habits that I won't go into, but I try not to make hay. So, this little blurb here, I can roll that ahead into the summer period without making much hay. If you like to make hay, that extreme spring growth followed by nothing in the summer is kind of cool. Sometimes you even get to feed that hay back in August. This situation here, we tend not to do that. But the point is, we can change the pasture community and take away some of those extremities that we really typically associate with fescue. Now, there's a lot of people who think fescue is just an aggressive, dominating grass that invades the pasture, chokes out everything else that's there, and then you have nothing but fescue. Fescue doesn't do that. Our grazing management does that. When I came to this station in 1980, a big part of our pastures were 90% fescue. Most of them now run 25 to 30%. Not because we went plowed them up, not because we sprayed them, but because we changed grazing management, did some interseeding, and now our typical pasture is this diverse mixture. We use no spring nitrogen fertilization at all. Any nitrogen we use is late summer to give us fall and winter forage. So we can change the shape of that growth curve even with a dominant, even with a grass that is perceived to be dominant and aggressive like fescue. I can kill tall fescue with red clover as fast as most people can kill red clover with fescue. First place I did it, Spindletop Farm right out here. I went to graduate school at UK, by the way, and that's where I learned to appreciate the power of red clover for smashing down tall fescue. And this idea... Now, I know in the Deep South it's a little more challenging, but from the Kentucky line on north, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, where we have lots of fescue, you can diversify the pasture, and you can really control fescue and reduce a lot of its effects. All right. So, I changed calving dates. I diversified the pasture. I solved the problem, right? Yeah. Oh. I guess for those of you who aren't real familiar with fescue, I want to explain something. For those of you who are familiar with fescue, I don't think it hurts to explain it more than once because, quite frankly, a lot of folks still just don't quite get it. All right, we have the endophytic fungus. It's present in the plant base at all times. Those nice little mycelium that both Carl and Richard showed the slides of. The fungus is always there. If you have an infected plant, it's always there. But there's times of the year when the plant is more toxic or less toxic than others. The leaves, the toxin is present in the leaves, but at a lower level. Leaves tend not to be as toxic as other parts of the plant. When the plant switches from the vegetative stage to reproductive stage, the fungus grows up the stem, infects the seed, and that is the most toxic part of the plant right there. The seeds, the stem. If we keep the plant from doing this, and I think, again, both of the previous speakers referred to keeping the plant vegetative to reducing some of the toxic fescue effects. You know, this is just like extension. We're going to tell you what we're going to tell you. We're going to tell you what we tell you, and then we're going to tell you what we told you. You know, you say it a lot, and eventually, you know, people kind of get it. And it's also good that, you know, when you have a symposium like this, the moderator's greatest fear is that he's going to have three speakers come up here and say different, conflicting things. It's good for discussion afterwards, but, you know, none of Carl, Richard, and I, we did not communicate. We just kind of did our own things, and it's nice that basically we are saying the same stuff, so you don't have to moderate a lot of fights later on. Okay, so that's when it's most toxic. If we can keep that from occurring, we have less problem. Yeah, that says it's most toxic. All right, fescue in the Midwest is most toxic in May and June. Now, a lot of people don't see their problems until July, August, even later. And so they have the idea that it's toxicity occurring at that time of the year. But when the animals really load up on whether it's ergotamine or ergovaline or lysergic acid, whatever they're loading up on, This is when it's happening. It's when that plant is in the reproductive stage and it's happening in late spring. If you have animals that have gone through the winter on infected fescue hay and are already in a challenged situation when they come to pasture like this, this is where you have the wrecks.